welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA, which we're recording on Thursday afternoon, and I'm at home for the first time in like 6 weeks. So that's good. It must mean that the offseason is settling in. This is going to be a little bit of a different podcast today because I'm going to have some authors on. Don't normally do that during the regular season, but this is an opportunity to do so. And so I want to highlight Matt Sullivan and Jake Fisher's work. So we're going to talk to them in a second. Before I do, we had a significant announcement at ESPN this week that our colleague Jackie McMullen is going to retire effective at the end of the month. If you are a listener of this podcast for any length of time, you knew that she was a central figure in growing and developing the Hoop Collective, a pillar of our Hoop Collective in so many ways, not just as a contributor to the show, but behind the scenes as well. And so we wish Jackie the absolute best. We obviously appreciate everything, and I appreciate everything that she's done for ESPN and also the NBA and also the sports writing world. So thank you so much, Jackie. You will always be welcome here, though, and enjoy retirement. Although I feel like she's going to stay in contact. She says she's not. She says, I'm done. I'm out of here. But I don't know about that. All right. So here we come with Matt Sullivan. Okay. So joining me, I don't always have, let's be honest with you, I never have guests on. But when the rare events that I do, it's often to have people talk about books because I've written 4 books. And I know that, when you are trying to let people know about a particular book, you know, the audience that listens to this podcast is, you know, type of audience that's interested in books, especially about basketball. Matt Sullivan is here. Matt, you know, I don't actually read books anymore. All of my book consumption is on audiobook. Did you do an audiobook for this book, which I will tell you right now is called Can't Knock the Hustle, Inside the Season of Protest, Pandemic, and Process with the Brooklyn Nets Superstars of Tomorrow. I always love the tagline. The tagline is, I'm sure, was agonized by your publisher many times.
It's too long. I tried to change it to Super Team instead of Superstars, and I didn't want to put Nets in there because I didn't want people only in Brooklyn to read it, because it's actually about folks all across the NBA. But to answer your question, I hate my voice and refuse to spend 12 hours reading it again when I read this thing ad nauseum. So my audiobook reader is great. You know, I love audiobooks too. Right before I started writing this thing or reporting it, I listened to The Breaks of the Game, David Halberstam's classic In Bed with the Blazers back in the late 70s. And I think I stole a lot of the vibe from that in not just following one team, but kind of meandering through the league and the state of fame and power. And so I'm not saying this is a sequel to one of the greatest books of all time, but it was definitely in me. It was in my ears.
Right. Well, my first sort of big book for a major publishing house, I did read the audiobook, and I thought I did fine, but the second time around they were like, we're going to hire an actor. So maybe I didn't do fine, but it is very tiring. I'll tell you that. So before we talk about, to me, there's something very fascinating about this book and the Nets, but which is what I really want to talk to you about. But first thing I'm going to ask you is, you got pretty good access for this book. At least you got interviews with the main characters, which don't always happen, especially in today's day and age when players have their own media companies. And even when they're willing to talk about a subject, they're going to control the four corners of the subject. So this is honestly a question as a reporter. I'm just genuine. How did you get people like Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant to actually sit with you to do this?
What I told Kevin Durant at the jump was that his whole saga in the Bay, Kyrie's soap operas in Cleveland and Boston, they've been covered ad nauseum, brilliantly by you in a villainizing way on Twitter. And I told him, no offense, but I don't really care about your on-the-court stuff. And You know, my book does include a non-Nets flashback in each chapter, dating back to the decision and covering the entire kind of player empowerment movement and its influence. Shout out to your books for the inspiration, Brian. But, you know, I told KD that I wasn't digging for dirt, and I think I was straight about that. Now, still, you plant the seeds with 400 plus interviews and something's going to blossom, right? But something like Kyrie, unprovoked, sending me a 67-page Supreme Court ruling on indigenous land rights and going off on mental health and work. But I honestly think it's just because I was asking questions as an intellectual peer and not a longtime NBA sports reporter. You know, I had edited the likes of Howard Beck and Jonathan Abrams and Tom Haberstroh kind of behind the scenes, but these guys didn't know me in the locker room. And so I came in with my fancy clothes and nice sneakers and asked Kyrie about Kobe.
What did you wear? What were your shoe choice that you wore to these interviews? Was that important? I assume that's important for these guys. That
definitely. I didn't wear their shoes, but I wore, you know, the Jordan 3s that had the special Chicago logo on the back, and that impressed Wilson Chandler. And then he started going off on the NBA as a plantation. I wore my brand new Devin Booker versions of the Air Force Ones, and Kyrie was wearing them on the same day. And so we kind of gave each other a nod. And there was reading too. I would drop off, you know, when Kyrie was coping with Kobe, I dropped, you know, maybe I was kissing his butt a little, but dropped off a Black Elk Teachings from the Sioux Nation, which, you know, I know you've been deep inside the head of Kyrie Irving yourself, including.
I don't even know where I've been. Honestly, I don't. He's one of the most. I don't even know, but I mean, I'll just say about Kyrie before you go on. I don't want to interrupt you. Is in 20 years of covering the NBA, there's nobody like him I've ever covered, and he's a breathtaking player. And no matter what anybody says, he loves the game, because nobody could ever master the game the way that he does without loving it. Because he has mastered it. I mean, he has mastered some technical aspects of the game in ways that I've never seen before. But, you know, this is so interesting. Like, you're saying that you wanted to talk to Kyrie off the court. To me, I'm like, when Kyrie steps off the court, he goes into mystical land, and I don't know what the freak he's talking about sometimes.
Well, he's hard to get to know, right? I mean, he's constantly evolving and blabbing, and I think his people around him tell him to be more concise, clear. I mean, Kyrie also hasn't agreed to a single on-the-record sit-down interview with a reporter, at least one that wasn't on his own media platform or on the Nets broadcast partner, since he joined the Nets, really. I mean,
right. This is why I'm starting off asking this.
I mean, there's things I can and can't talk about with journalistic rules, but I mean, and apparently Kyrie has a big interview coming on this Players TV startup that he put $500,000 into, and get this, Kyrie is apparently directing a documentary about himself. And so that should be pretty postmodern or ancient or all of the above.
I mean, Matt, I have no idea. Like you say that, I have no idea. Like, honestly, like this is going to sound funny. Like, it honestly could just be like colors and shapes.
Totally.
I don't know what makes him tick. I really don't.
I think he's figuring it out. You know, I mean, he's at once more transparent than a lot of players and more guarded, because he was so villainized as a young man. And I think, you know, KD says, it's just because he wanted to leave Boston and he wanted to leave Cleveland, player empowerment, yada, yada. But I think he's legit figuring it out as a man, you know, how to do fatherhood the right way now that he's kind of had a son with a partner rather than not with a partner, and how to do activism and humanitarianism, how to actually show up for his teammates and not just be that guy who disappears for days at a time. I mean, I think there's a whole chapter in my book, Brian, and I won't totally spoil it here to ruin anyone's beach read. You can pick it up at your local bookseller. But, you know, I'd venture to say that it's the most fair and accurate 21 pages on this dude in his career. You know, he's at home, he's alone with his kid and his nanny. He doesn't like have people over. You know, Colin Kaepernick isn't coming over for dinner or anything. He's injured, he's depressed, which he is open about. And he asks himself, you know, when he's going to turn the corner, where, he asks himself, is the corner. And so I think a lot of Brooklyn's kind of title hopes for the next several years really do depend on Kyrie finding himself on and off the court, because they're just, inextricably linked. And as much as Kai claims to separate his day job from his, you know, real world influence, and as much as he claims to block out the haters, you know, even though that's clearly impossible for a modern superstar athlete, I think, you know, Harden said it in a new interview that came out just the other hour. You know, he says, quote, as long as we win and as long as we handle our business on the court, our work off the court will reach the same level. And I hope that's true. But, you know, with this team, with these players, especially with Kyrie, the next soap opera is just around the corner, right?
Right. So, I mean, like, this is the thing about this book, like the access that you get with these players, particularly the stars, is very unusual in today's day and age for an independent reporter. You know, Durant has the boardroom. You know, he just had an interview that came out with Draymond Green, which was on the Bleacher Report, but was within Draymond's sphere. And they, in a strange way, threw Bob Myers and Steve Kerr under the bus. And it was such a strange, it was such a strange conversation. I don't even want to talk about it because it was so ridiculous. That's really one of the things I took away from this is like, man, you were able to convince these guys. And did you know them? Like, did they know you from Adam when you approached them?
No. Right. I mean, I had my spiel, you know, that I'd done this and I'd worked as a non-sports journalist and led an investigation.
Yeah. I mean, you worked at the New York Times, you worked at the Bleacher Report, you worked at the Guardian. I don't know. I probably should have given your bio, but I didn't want to take up too much time with it, but you know, you are not a traditional NBA reporter, I think.
But I think that they, you know, there's a revisionist legacy polishing to things like that Draymond interview, which, as I said, is basically a vehicle for Draymond's second career and a way to kill a half hour when these guys are coming back from Team USA practice in Vegas. I think on the same day that KD was in a hotel room with Kanye listening to his new album. And, you know, I think that, as many things do, have the veneer of player propaganda on their own media outlets. You know, I think they even hashed out that whole Clippers argument on KD's podcast back in April. Right. And I think, you know, and still KD, as I report in my book, you know, he had told a longtime confidant that one of the reasons he ended up leaving the Warriors was because he thought Steve Kerr wasn't holding Draymond accountable for these outbursts. That, you know, that and all the attention Steph got, which KD has also denied on his like Twitter Spaces propaganda hosted by his podcast co-host. But it's true. He said in private that that's true. And so I would go get these sources on the record. I mean, you know that you need a ton of on background unquoted sources to put together the detail that goes into a long book. But I got a lot of people on the record just because I went there. I went to KD's rec center and talked for like 3 hours with his longtime coach. And I would just be everywhere. You know, KD would turn around. I was like in his shoe closet in his apartment with his roommate because I was interested in his roommate's KD12's special collab. And you know, I just noticed details there. Like,
why does KD need a roommate? Split the rent?
He's got two roommates and the security guard who got in that little tussle with PJ in the conference finals.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it's the infantilization or the, you know, simplification of KD as a dude who smokes weed and plays video games. It's an entourage. I mean, it's a straight up entourage. He's pushed people away from his inner circle, which he said in the Draymond interview, pushed away his mother, you know, people taking advantage of his money. And he keeps his circle pretty tight, but I also think the Kevin Durant boardroom veneer, you know, nail polish, manicuring is a lot of people, you know, putting his name on things. And to some extent, as some of the startups who have taken investments from 35 Ventures have said, you know, is just kind of a publicity stunt. And then they don't stick around for very long. And look, Rich Kleiman and Kevin have done phenomenally well for themselves by using the clout for technology and good on them. But it's just interesting to see what KD is passionate about and what he, you know, follows in LeBron's footsteps a lot.
Right. This has happened with LeBron too. LeBron gets in on deals because they get to say LeBron is on the deal. There's a value to that. And LeBron reaps that value in investments. And, you know, like if LeBron's going to invest in your company, he's going to invest at a certain discount, if it's even investing at all, whether you give him equity. And if you want to be able to say that LeBron invested in your company, it's one thing to be able to say that LeBron invested in your company to other investors to give money. Hmm. That's one sort of price cost. If you want to say publicly that LeBron is investing in your company, that's going to cost you even more. And like, you know, and Kevin, especially when he was with the Warriors and like there was, Silicon Valley IPO opportunities walking in the first five rows of the Oracle Arena every night for 3 years. He took, I don't know if he took full advantage, but he took advantage of it. And he got in on some investments. And I mean, you hear he's an investor in these various products. You never know how much he got in for, whatever, but he's, I don't know if he's hit any grand slams, but he's hit some homers. He's hit some doubles.
Yeah, but I think as you document in LeBron Inc., LeBron has set the template, but they've also made some smart moves. Mav getting in early on Beats, which made them a gazillion dollars. And I think in tracing the history of the player empowerment, picking up where some of your and Dave's books left off, a lot of people are just trying to copy LeBron. A lot of people are trying to do the anti-LeBron, be the non-LeBron, the Spencer Dinwiddies of the world, trying to IPO their own contracts. And then there's someone like Kyrie who is legitimately trying to, also figure out how to rebuild his high school and pay tuition without taking credit for it, while LeBron has like a show on Quibi about I Promise, right? And I think that's the duality that I didn't really want to psychoanalyze the difference between LeBron and Kai, because it's been, again, written about ad nauseum. But I do think it's interesting that Kyrie is trying to develop his own personal brand without taking credit for any of it. And that represents, I think, a departure and maybe a divide, again, without being too divisive, between the mainstream, safe, A-list way of approaching things, even when it comes to activism, to the bubble, to Black Lives Matter t-shirts. And then you've got the Kyrie version of the kind of rebel camp that would buy a house for the family of George Floyd and not say anything about it. That would, as detailed in a part of the book that's excerpted on The Undefeated, try to do this boycott of the bubble, but kind of fail because he can't unite those two wings of, the LeBron class.
I don't know if Kyrie's a uniter of anything, but yet he does so much good. He's a very difficult man to understand, and you're right. But and that's here's honestly, Matt, here's what I actually wanted to talk to you about, because I think this is the most in-depth thing that you can see written on the Nets, who are probably going to be the team of the next 3 to 5 years, although who knows. In my 20 years covering the NBA, I'm not sure a more fascinating thing that I've ever seen is Kyrie Irving getting Kevin Durant to marry him, essentially, to couple with him. Doing it in Brooklyn, when you really look at it, what Brooklyn had done and what it offered, doing it in Brooklyn isn't really, I got that. I mean, that was a unique road, but it wasn't a road that didn't make sense. I mean, it was a moment where, you could go into the Knicks or the Nets, and you took the Nets, and it was the same, sort of time where Kawhi could have had the Lakers or Clippers and picked Clippers. Same with Paul George.
The Nets wanted, Kenny Atkinson wanted Kawhi, for the record, but I know what you mean. It's like, there is the easy public excuse of saying, oh, beautiful practice facility and a great GM and great pieces. And remember, Kyrie got in trouble for saying they need more pieces and the new owner and a great city. But I think really it was a franchise that they could control top to bottom. And Kyrie and KD, I was there, the All-Star game when the kind of Zapruder tape of two max slots went viral. We're all trying to read their lips, but And probably a lot of people presuming that they meant the Knicks. But as I report in my book, they were at a kind of low point in their lives earlier than that. In January 2019, KD comes up to play the Celtics with the Warriors. They have dinner at Kai's place in the Boston suburbs. And Kyrie had been through this rough period since you visited the Standing Rock Reservation with him. And then his grandfather died. And as he told KD, you know, after that point, basketball just wasn't the most important thing to me, which I believe. KD didn't like his situation for reasons I mentioned. And it was just kind of like, okay, Brooklyn. And I don't think it was Kyrie necessarily playing recruiter so much as downtrodden friend. They had been through this thing that they kind of cheesily call the top of the mountain, right? They'd won already. They didn't need that, but they wanted that feeling. And I think they had the opposite of that feeling, being, you know, second fiddle, even though they're the best, like KD and Kai, still feeling this desire to build something on his own terms.
And that's, but see, that's, I'm gonna stop right there. KD doesn't play second fiddle to anybody. This man is such an incredible talent. Anybody who doesn't think that his guys, the Warriors, they won in 2015. They were a great team, but that finals could have gone either way. Okay. They won. It was great. They won. Awesome. Okay. 2016, they lost. They should have won, but they lost. And I'm telling you, the 2017 Cavs were the best team LeBron maybe has ever been on. So Kevin Durant won him that title. I mean, like, it just, it's crazy to me that people delegitimize. I mean, this is a soft spot for me, Matt, people who delegitimize NBA titles because they're so damn hard to win. Okay, in 2018, the league had been sort of defeated by the Warriors at that point. You know, Kyrie had broken off, and the Cavs got their wheezing and coughing. They could have won that title without Durant, but the league got broken because of the 2017 Warriors with Durant. Durant doesn't owe anybody anything. He doesn't owe anybody anything.
But that's exactly what he told Gordon Hayward told me that's what he said in terms of loyalty when Gordon was thinking about leaving Utah, which every player kind of wants to leave Utah. And Gordon said, KD advised him, you know, you don't owe anybody anything. And Andre Iguodala told me that he told KD, you know, at this point, screw everybody, you know, management, your teammates, do what makes you happy. And I think that's what's interesting is that Kyrie could kind of lead the way, find the franchise that was going to bend to their will, the coach that they thought was going to bend to their will.
But he didn't need Kyrie for that.
No, and that's what he says. You know, KD's dad was texting with him when KD had already made up his mind. He'd actually already made up his mind while he was playing in the finals for the Warriors in 2019. But his dad thought that he still had a chance to turn him to become a Knick, because his dad's a Knicks fan. And, you know, he said, the Knicks is Mecca. If you want to do it big. If you want to be a New Yorker, be a Knick. And you know, I think KD's whole thing is like, Brooklyn is chill, on the low, all black everything, play with his friends. And his dad texted him, said, are you doing this just for Kyrie because he's your buddy? And KD said, no, he's making this decision for himself. And I think it's similar to what he told Steve Nash, actually, you know, that he wanted to challenge himself with the Warriors, which I think is kind of BS. But this time, I think it was about doing things completely on his own terms, even if he wasn't leading the charge. He was
okay. So then why, again, all that is great stuff, which you have. Again, I go back to why this is so fascinating. Then why Kyrie? Why? I mean, if you want to control the thing, why don't you be the leader and you go pick your guys? As opposed, I mean, Kyrie was the guy who let, right? Kyrie was the leader to Brooklyn.
Like they both prefer insulation from you, me, Twitter, haters, right? And I think KD said
but Kevin doesn't.
Like this. But he said, you know, even like he doesn't like the word happiness, you know, not an efficient way for me. I don't want to chase happiness. And I think that's what Sean Marks made a deal with Kyrie, that you came here, you can talk to the media as much as you want and break the rules there. You can show up to practice as much as you want and we won't give you any gruff. And I think Kyrie has pushed those limits more recently and pissed off Joe Tsai when he, you know, took a 2-week leave of absence in January, February. But it comes down to what Steve Nash told the team this year that Kenny Atkinson kind of couldn't figure out the year before, which is Steve's kind of secret motto, protect the group. they don't have to answer to anybody but themselves on the court. And I think that's what KD said as well. You know, stick me in a gym with 9 other guys and a basketball and a backpack and I'll be happy as can be. I honestly don't think Kevin Durant cares if there's fans in the stadium because of the Delta variant, because he wants to hoop with his friends on his terms and just have that feeling again, which is weird because it's kind of the same feeling he expressed on the Warriors. Like, we're going to win every night.
Well, look, I know, like, whatever tale that Draymond and KD or whoever else want to tell, KD was gone from the Warriors before that season started. Right. And Steve Kerr even came down. I think it was like at media day. He was like, well, this is going to be our last ride. So like, if you want to say that something happened in Los Angeles or something happened in Boston or something happened in New Orleans, that like, you know, it's not me. If that's the way KD feels, fine. But KD was gone. That was it. He was gone from that season. I am amazed that KD doesn't play on a team where he doesn't shoot the ball every single time. He is so freaking good. And he is so skilled and he is so brilliant. I would just give him the ball every single time. Like, I was just in Tokyo and Team USA, like, I know that Pop like applied some techniques and got them to move the ball better and like emphasize defense. I know that Drew Holiday's ball pressure like unnerved some of the other teams. I know that like Jason Tatum accepting a role off the bench was really big. Like, I could go on and on about that team. That team became a great team when Kevin Durant started playing because the guy is a supernova. He might be the most skilled player of all time. I would say he's the most skilled player of all time, but every time you say all time, it launches 1,000 arguments and I'm not interested in that. I've never seen a guy who has the mastery of the game like he does.
But Kyrie treats him as a peer. And I thought that was the interesting thing in all the recreation of the building of this team, a true super team, that Kyrie would say, oh yeah, Kev's coming too. Kev's coming too. And that, you know, Kyrie would go on to say, like, we're all the coach. And I think, I mean, you followed Bron and Kyrie much longer than I have, obviously. Do you think that Kyrie was trying to play LeBron, to play GM as best he could, and he had the trump card to play and he played it? Do you think that this was a long con for a super team all along? I mean, I know the Harden thing was in the works for much longer than,
well, yeah, I mean, from last summer at least, right?
Yes.
Well, look, I mean, like Kyrie, again, when he steps off the court, I really have a difficult time trying to figure out what's going on there. And I don't think I'm alone. Okay. I respect and that you were able to connect with him on that level. I don't think I could. And that's probably why you're sitting with him and I'm not, you know, but I will say that whatever Joe Tsai gets frustrated about with Kyrie, Joe Tsai being the Nets owner, or like whatever, like if they have a bad day or a bad week or a bad month with Kyrie, if Sean Marks, the GM, and Steve Nash, the coach, have bad, like they owe Kyrie so much because Kyrie greased the skid to bring Kevin Durant there. And Kevin Durant got James Harden there. And that is so valuable that you almost have to section it off and say, Kyrie, you have given Nets more than anybody ever has because you have delivered these guys, because that's how valuable Durant is. Because in my view, as great as Kyrie is, he's not even on the same, nowhere near the same level. And I know maybe Kevin doesn't feel that way. And Kevin would say, well, you're not a basketball player. You don't know. And maybe I don't.
Well, I think that's why they bow down before him. And, you know, it's a bit of something that Kai learned from Kobe, right? Like, somebody's got to be the a-hole in the room. And I think KD knows that. That's what KD thinks goes into something of a quote-unquote
championship. Yeah, but we all could understand Kobe. Kobe was transparent. Mm-hmm. Kobe was like, we're going to put more points on that scoreboard than the other team. And whatever it needs to happen for me to get to that, if I have to cut 15 of you along the way, I'm going to do it.
I do think Kyrie has kind of run out of a bit of string with management, even though he doesn't think he owes them any explanation.
Well, now that Durant signed, I mean, like, let me ask you this, Matt, because I really honestly believe you know the Nets' personalities better than anybody. I wonder if Sean Marks had the same types of conversations that you've had with these guys. So let me ask you this. Durant has signed his extension. Kyrie is eligible for the same extension. Kyrie has openly said numerous times, basketball is not the most important thing to me. Like I said, Kyrie has given the Nets this gift. Can you sign a guy to a $200 million extension or whatever the number is who isn't 100% committed to that job?
Joe Tsai can certainly afford it, but I don't think...
Well, that's not the question.
No, of course, but I don't think the Nets owner was happy at all when Kai failed to properly communicate why he was ditching the team in late January and early February of this year. You know, that quote, pause, it was described to me by people who are still very close to him as a kind of spiritual, mental, and emotional break, which was very much precipitated by the Capitol riot and the lack of charges against the cop who shot Jacob Blake, and coinciding with his partner being pregnant with his first son. And so, look, for the first time in a long time, Kyrie apologized. You know, he wanted to apologize, and he knows that he brings this stuff upon himself. He's becoming slightly more self-aware, just like he did, you know, apologize for the Boston fans distracting his team the season before. But it's a question of whether that self-awareness can be consistent and whether a humility that he occasionally expresses in what I think he would admit is a vacillation between being locked in and being somewhat depressed and inside himself. He's said, kind of jokingly, I could see myself disappearing off into the desert with a cloak and growing out my afro. I do think people very close to him have expressed that they think he could retire early, that they wouldn't have been surprised if after Kobe's death, if he just never played again. But I do think he has a legitimate sense that he needs to lock in a little more, that this is an easy championship with him and James and Kev healthy. And so I think that question becomes harder 2 years from now, two titles from now. He did say he wanted his goal, which is, again, sort of the delusions of grandeur, and especially Kyrie. When he got to Nets, he said he wanted to win multiple championships with the Nets. He wanted to be considered one of the greatest point guards of all time, which his trainer then told him, well, you're not even the best point guard in the league right now, which is, you know, who knows, maybe why doesn't consider himself a point guard anymore. But that was kind of it. So if he checks those goals off his list, he has to think on these goals and his vision boards, beautiful mind, whiteboard, painting, whatever. I think management will let him do what he wants. Like you said, he's going to get the money. But I could see him definitely continuing to do his disappearing act, because I haven't seen any signs that anybody's going to stop him from doing it.
Well, they can't. I mean, they owe him a lot. And now he's pressing the bounds of it. Like, again, when you see Kyrie make this incredible, like, quadruple crossover, get into the lane, and then throw up a shot that has, like, 45-degree angle backspin that hits, like, upper left side of the backboard and goes through the net and with a foul, it's like, oh, my God. This is amazing. And like, I remember asking him one day when he was in Cleveland, how do you do that? Because I would be at these practices at the end of these practices, and he doesn't work on that. I didn't see him do it. He obviously worked on it a lot, because how do you do it? And he just said, Kyrie was probably one of the first players of the YouTube generation. When he was a kid, he would watch YouTube in his room. He would see these plays, whether they were from streetball players or they were from NBA players or they were from whoever. He would go outside immediately in his driveway and try to mimic the moves. That is totally linear and makes sense of a guy who loves basketball. That is the it's actually, in my view, a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story of how he developed into this. I can't find the linear with Kyrie anymore. The linear is gone, and that's fine, but you have to make decisions as an organization based on linear stuff. You know, we got 82 games and we got four rounds of playoffs. You know, we're running horns on this one. We're running a 1-3 pick and roll over here. You know, like,
I mean, there are days, Brian, when he is not in that razzle dazzle mode at all. There are weeks when his philosophy changes to, well, I'm not here to dance, which I think it's a very mature approach, but you can also see it in his face. He looks like a, you know, sad puppy dog face. He looks he looks depressed on the court, and he did when he got back from that leave of absence. And I think, look, there's a lot of rumors that fly around press boxes in general, but especially about this guy that I didn't really, I found it kind of seedy to dig into. So I'm not going to get into that, but I do think there's a psychology and a mental health aspect to this that he is very transparent about. And Jackie McMullen is incredible, but I think there was a quote in her story when I was first reporting this book that was taken way out of context about his quote unquote mood swings. And he said, mood swings are okay. And I think he still rides and dies by that. But I think he, you know, in public, but I think in private, it's gnawing at him still. And he doesn't know what he wants to be. He doesn't have a linear track, and he is unpredictable to himself. And I think that's dangerous for the Nets. They know it. I'm not saying James Harden was an insurance policy, but there could very well be Kyrie disappearing for games during the regular season next year. And I could see him
disappear. You know,
there was something I said on another podcast that got taken out of context about, you know, they might be listening to trade offers. I think it's about being fed up with a player, and Sean Marks listens to everybody. I don't know. You tell me, do you think Kevin Durant would stab his buddy in the back if it came to that? Now that he's got his other buddy there, I don't know. Maybe that's speculation, but
I think Kevin could shoot the ball every single time and it would be smart basketball. It's not the way he plays. It's not the way he wants to play. And I appreciate him for that. I think I have absolutely nothing. I don't have one criticism for Kevin Durant's game at all. I think he's absolutely brilliant. And if he is happy with Kyrie there and he wants Kyrie there, then the Nets have to keep Kyrie there. Whatever Kevin wants, you got to do, because.
And there's a lot riding on Steve Nash to babysit these guys and to level with Kai, which I think he's done really well so far. Now, look, KD also really wanted Steve there, and they were chopping it up on Manhattan Beach in the middle of COVID. And, you know, all the other rumors about Pop or whatever were just a smokescreen. And so Kevin runs the show. Someone just needs to tell Kyrie that it's still his team.
I mean, which I think is insane. I don't think it should be his team, but you know, USA Basketball let Kevin run it a lot too. Mm. You know, he pretended like he didn't have any say, but he had a lot of say. And
same with Kenny Atkinson getting fired. I mean, there's a long section in my book that I was surprised people were as open as they were about, but you know, the sky of the Slim Reaper definitely came down. I mean, Kenny, who's now Kerr's assistant with Golden State, you know, he didn't know that he had KD pulling as many strings as he did. And he realized too late, and he saw the hammer coming down. He slipped out the door because he knew that he was getting fired, which he would be the first to admit, but he maybe the second to admit, but he didn't know how to be a player empowerment coach. And I think you kind of have to be these days if you're going to win it all. And so Steve Nash is, I think, the perfect fit for this team, and that he doesn't even really have to coach. He just needs to babysit.
That moment in that Bucks series where Nash is hugging Durant. This is a first ballot Hall of Famer, 2-time MVP. He's no Kevin Durant. Hmm. He was no Kevin Durant as a player. That's how damn good Durant is. And you know, that's the one thing about people who have been around the NBA and really know the lay of the land. Like, they'll admit, like, if I have to go because this guy says I have to go, then I have to go.
But Kyrie's still pulling those strings. I mean, Garrett Temple, who's a major kind of off the court figure in this book, was telling me on election day when KD, Kyrie, Chris Paul, and James Harden were playing pickup together in Kobe's old gym, and Garrett had just gotten off the phone with KD, who said everything's going to be okay, we're going to re-sign you, don't worry about it. Garrett's there, you know, having real talk about how he hadn't talked with Kyrie since they disagreed on this whole bubble boycott. And Garrett told me, you know, players have a lot of say nowadays in this league. Players in the leadership, if you go against what they want you to do, then they won't want you back. And if that's the case, then I don't want to be on this team. But Kyrie is the enigma of the century. So who knows? So Kyrie's definitely pulling a lot of strings.
Garrett Temple is on the Players Association board with Kyrie Irving.
Well, is Kyrie Irving really on the Players Association board? How many of those Zoom calls is he showing up to?
Again, in a linear world, if you're on the Players Association board and you're in the Players Association is working 24 hours a day to put the bubble together, somebody on the board, even if they disagreed with what was going on, like they didn't have to all be in unison. That's why you have a variety of people there. But, you know, Kyrie is off trying to do his own thing because Kyrie doesn't do things linear. And maybe the beauty that he has with his game can only come from a mind that is not linear. But, you know, teams have to make decisions linearly to a certain extent. But, you know, the Durant with Kyrie thing has the potential to be one of the most impactful things that happens in this league in this generation. Because now that they have Harden, I mean, again, so many things have to happen right to win. But, I mean, they are such an incredibly talented team. Like, if they don't win a title this year or next, it's almost a travesty. And so that the creation of that, you know, it's the beginning of the super teams, which was the Celtics and then really the Heat. Even though that was controversial, you could look at it and understand it. You understand why LeBron, Wade, and Bosh would play together. You may not like it, depending on who your team is and depending on what you believe is, you know, a champion should look like, but you understand it. The Kyrie Durant, and I know that like there was this whole thing and you've written about it, about how, why they appealed to each other, but it's still fascinating to me. And this book is potentially the source material for how this very potentially incredible marriage came together. And I think it potentially could age really well. And I'm not just telling you that, Matt, because I don't do that. And it's Can't Knock the Hustle by Matt Sullivan. And I mean, if you're a Nets fan, you've already read this book. I don't know how you couldn't have, but if you are fascinated by the modern NBA, this book only adds layers to this era that we're very much in, that's developing by the week almost, but certainly by the season. From a reporter standpoint, it's not like most basketball books. So, thank you, Matt, for coming on. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you, Brian. Thanks again for being the inspiration for this. Your book.
Oh,
really...
don't say that. That's bull. No.
I would say that to other people, but I have lots and lots of Return of the King and LeBron Inc. underlined and lots of credit given to you in the end of the book. And I know you'll continue to chart where this is all going because like I said, the soap opera never stops with these guys.
Yeah. I just will say that I've been there for a lot of Kevin Durant's highest moments. I've been there when he's grasped the finals MVPs. I've been there. I was just there in Tokyo when he got the gold, one of the more fascinating guys. So thank you so much. I appreciate it. Take care. Thanks for stopping by.
Appreciate you, man. Take care.
Vivid Seats wants you to get to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seat Rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code HOOP. That's code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Visit vividseats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavily on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liquor, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Now I'm joined by Jake Fisher, who is becoming a newsbreaker in the NBA. Jake, your name is expanding, is because you're all over this news. I hate the news game. I'm glad you like it.
I didn't say I liked it.
Oh, okay, good. But he's also an author, which is, you know, why he's here, quite frankly, because I have respect for authors. His book came out earlier this year. It's called Built to Lose: How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. And the tanking, people talk about it a lot during the season, especially in this last 3 to 5 years. But where tanking matters, and the reason you do it, happens in the summer, because that's when you get the draft picks. And to me, the NBA draft is one of the most difficult and consequential things in all sports, because one player, as you know, but anything can change everything. And a lot of times that player is the number one or two or three pick, but a lot of times he isn't. Case in point, Giannis Antetokounmpo. And the desire and the need to get those top picks is everything. And, you know, we just see this, we just saw Summer League, where so many of these guys like are going to change these organizations because of the draft. And it's always been true, Jake, but it almost feels like it took Sam Hinkie to really crystallize just how all in teams have to be to do it. And I think honestly, it's because for so long, former players were, you tell me if you think I'm out of my mind here. This is, you know, I always thought that for so long, former players or lifelong basketball people,
yes,
were league executives. And you tell a guy who his whole life has been built on competition that you're not trying to win every game, and that just doesn't fly. And then a lot of owners felt the same way. But we moved into a new era in the last 15 years where a lot of owners were not raised in that type style or became wealthy in that style. And a lot of the executives became guys who use spreadsheets and thought more analytically, not because they want people to take three-pointers, but because they just looked at the lay of the land and said, you know, it's kind of important to get a number top three pick. Maybe we should do everything in our power to do a top three pick. And really, maybe that should have what people should have been doing back in the 80s. And it just took until the 2000s, 2010s to figure it out. And you explore that in this book.
For sure. I mean, it's right in the introduction where I went to Orlando Summer League in 2014, a year into Sam Hinkie's process, and Isaiah Thomas, the older Isaiah Thomas, not the Celtics fame and then the Lakers and wherever he's at now.
The Isaiah Thomas.
He was there for broadcasting for NBA TV. And he was talking about what the Sixers are doing as this affront to the game and how it was ruining professional basketball and sport as we know it. Right. So I agree with your sentiment. And I do think that, you know, the rise of analytical minded executives coming to power on the league, you know, really helped push this strategy to the forefront too, being that it wasn't just Sam Hinkie at the time, right? It was, you know, Rob Hennigan in Orlando as well. We had Brian McDonough comes from Boston to take over Phoenix that same season. And excuse me, people forget that Daryl Morey came from Boston as well when, you know, Danny Ainge and his forward-thinking front office, they traded KG and Paul Pierce to Brooklyn the same night that Sam Hinkie traded Drew Holiday to New Orleans as well. So I do agree with you that it was a widespread effort of these newer age, you know, analytical minded spreadsheet thinking guys, like you said, realizing that, you know, that the top talent is clearly more available in the top five, and the most direct route to getting them, especially if you're not Los Angeles or New York, where they're always going to be free agent destinations, which, you know, we've seen that more with Brooklyn that less than the Knicks. But if you're not a glamour market, the most direct route to getting a superstar and having him under team control for years is through the draft.
Yeah. And it really, the tanking issue is such a touchstone thing for so many people. But I always have to say this. It's common sense if you're around an NBA team, but you know, tanking happens on the injured list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tanking happens with who's inactive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, occasionally, and also tanking happens with what you do with your roster also. I mean, you trade your star players, like, I'm not sure we've seen a more compelling case of tanking than we just saw this last season with the Thunder.
I agree.
Because in the case of the 76ers, like, they, you know, broke their roster down, and, you know, just frankly had bad players or really young players who had no experience that were just going to lose games because they just hadn't played together. I mean, what was their worst record, Jake? Like, they, I get, you know, they had the 20 game losing streak, yeah, or whatever.
10 and 72, right. That 15-16 season that got the number one pick for Ben Simmons.
Right. So they had 10 and 72 talent, quite frankly.
Yeah.
The Thunder have, and by the way, like, nobody calls the Thunder on this, probably because it's graduated to the next level, right? Because it's normalized tanking. The Thunder, like, iced their two best players, iced them. You know, I know Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he did have plantar fasciitis, but, like, they shut him down and they sent Al Horford home. And by the way, they just announced it. Mm-hmm. Like, they just, you know, Al Horford will no longer be playing for us so that he can go home. And by the way, Al Horford was like, well, I want out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I want to do is go get hurt. So like, it's one of the most extreme cases of tanking that I've ever seen. And I'm not saying it with venom. I'm just saying it matter of factly.
It is.
By the way, they had the worst luck on lottery night too.
I know. And, you know, I was just in Las Vegas for Summer League, right? And I think that's a topic that came up a lot, talking to executives and agents and the news breaking sources, if you will. And, you know, what the Thunder did this season, I mean, it wasn't just OKC too. I mean, Houston put John Wall on their bench and just handed the keys over to Kevin Porter Jr. And Orlando traded away all their guys at the deadline, and they sat Terrence Ross, and Detroit just waves Blake Griffin. And what they did was far more brazen than anything Sam Hinkie ever did.
And I agree. Right, Jake. Nobody calls anybody on it. Hinkie continues to take the bullets.
He does. He does. And I think, you know, one big difference is, you know, I quote unquote went to Sam Presti's end of season Zoom press conference, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he starts off with this 30-minute monologue, this soliloquy about how they want to be patient and take their time and build a contender and a champion that is worthy of the hardworking people of Oklahoma City. And to do so, you know, it's going to be this plight, this path that does feature a lot of fortune and ping pong balls, but no matter what, they're going to keep their eye on the prize. And this is that. That's something Sam Hinkie never did. And I think one reason why Sam Presti is considered to be one of, if not the best GMs in the game right now, is that he's able to be an expert at all facets of the job, including the public relations department, where, you know, I reported Bleacher Report before the draft that they offer Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in a package for the Pistons' number one pick. Sam Presti denies it. And all of the Thunder fans are coming at me saying, oh, Sam Presti said this, like automatically accepting it as fact. So I think that's not to, you know, call out Sam Presti. That's to say that's just how expertly he's handled the massaging of what they've done.
Sam also has a decade plus. I don't know. He's been there longer than that. He's got 15 years.
A lot of time.
Of building championship contenders there. They haven't, unfortunately, haven't won it.
For
but
sure.
He has equity, whereas Hinkie didn't. But you're right. Sam Presti has come out and said it. Now, what Sam would tell you if he could speak, well, I mean, how do I want to say this? Sam's like, there's a reason why the Thunder are going about this. And the reality is they can't, they're not going to get free agents. Maybe at some point, if they build a championship level team and there's a player who, you know, is an Andre Iguodala type player, you know, sort of not a one, you know, I'm not saying that someday they couldn't get a big free agent. You know, LaMarcus Aldridge went to San Antonio, for example, like that could happen, but today they're not a free agent destination. If Bradley Beal doesn't extend the summer, becomes a free agent next year, he is probably not going to be considering Oklahoma City. So they can't build through free agency, at least star players. And in the current NBA, star players, for the most part, control the trade market.
Yes.
Like Chris Paul, like with Sam Presti, directed himself to Phoenix. James Harden, even though it was at the tip of a spear, directed himself to Brooklyn. Yeah. You know, Westbrook has done this several times. Like if a megastar of a certain level is available by trade, and that's why the Damian Lillard situation, if he gets to that point, everybody hear me? Mm-hmm. Will be fascinating because he's under contract for 4 years and would have much less leverage. Like, for example, if Bradley Beal decided he wanted to be traded, he would have some control over a direction because he's got 1 year on his contract and he could just be like, well, I'm not going to resign. You know, Anthony Davis did this.
Yep. You know, thanks.
Boston had the assets to do it. Jaylen Brown would look gorgeous in a Pelicans uniform right now. although they got Brandon Ingram, but he's like, I'm not resigning there. And so he controlled where he was going. And right now, I don't think Oklahoma City, even with all those first round draft picks, like if Damian Lillard or Bradley Beal asked for a trade today, tell me who could put together a better package than Oklahoma City. They could put together one of the greatest trade packages in the history of the game.
Agreed.
But is Bradley Beal going to commit to resigning there? So if you're the Thunder, you're sitting there going, all right, well, we really can't count on signing Bradley Beal. It's going to be really hard for us to trade for a guy like Bradley Beal. Lillard's a different topic and maybe we'll get there down the road. We'll see. So what is our way of getting back to the top? Our way of getting back to the top is drafting and developing players. So therefore their focus as an organization is to do everything they possibly can to get and draft and get multiple bites at the apple because they're getting a lot of draft picks because sometimes you get Giannis at the 13th pick. And sometimes you get, LeBron at the number one pick or whatever. But that's why they're doing it. Sure. But it is way more brazen than what Hinkie did. But yet, Hinkie was, the first through the door, right? The first through the door takes the most fire, right?
For sure. And I think you hit on a really important aspect of this, which I kind of developed this thesis and pitched it around a lot of executives when reporting on the book. I think tanking played a big factor in furthering the player empowerment era, where you have multiple franchises saying we're willing to lose year after year after year just for the chance, not even a guarantee, just for the chance of being able to draft you. That's how important just one of you is, let alone if we get two, let alone if we get three. And I think, that's allowed players to realize, well, once I'm here, then you need to do everything I say or else I'm going to go elsewhere. And I think that has played, it's a Pandora's box. It's a vicious cycle, whatever expression you want to use, where the second Anthony Davis makes his trade request, like you mentioned, it opens the door now, inadvertently, where the Pelicans trickle down the standings in the very first year of lottery reform that got passed as a direct result of Sam Hinkie's process years. The Pelicans jump up to number one. They get Zion Williamson, and the clock is already ticking on the Pelicans, right, to do what they can to build a playoff contender.
Oh, it's ticking quite loudly, actually.
Right? So yeah. I think that aspect is also why the Thunder come into play here today, being that it seems like, again, I'm not in the building, but from conversations you have around the league, from assessing it from afar, it really seems like that the Thunder are trying to attack this from, you know, 75 feet before the starting line, if you will, right? Where they're trying to get these guys and build an organic winner and grow this group together with no pressure and create this culture, kind of like they did from 2007 to 2009, but recognizing the failures of that situation where they lose James Harden to Houston, Kendrick Perkins' contract comes into play and muddies up their books, and KD wants to go to Golden State. Like, it seems like they're already starting to try and preempt those types of situations and decisions early on here by stockpiling all these picks and having enough ammo to go and get your guy and build guys with certain characters and hire all these, you know, high school scouting evaluators from the media and from other private institutions to like really juice up their scouting department. That's, I think, the other element to this, where, you know, the subtitle of the book is also, you know, how the tanking era changed the league forever. Like, I don't think it's just the play-in tournament and the lottery reform. I think now we've had this streamlined conversation of team building and how every single front office is targeting, you know, two free agencies down the line. And I think that started with this whole draft, you know, projecting out and trying to build your team and seeing what type of free agent veteran talent you can add to your core 2-3 years in the future. And the Thunder might just be, you know, the amalgamation of all those ideas coming together here.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and on the Ways to Win podcast, coaches Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. Each week, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve your off-court problems. Whether it's trouble at home or a workplace dilemma, the coaches will help you find a winning formula for success. And you'll hear from prominent athletes, business leaders, and celebrities who reveal insights that made them into the leaders they are today. Like President Obama, who breaks down his bracket and talks about how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism. Listen to Ways to Win wherever you get your podcasts.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Well, the Nets are an example of this. I mean, when Sean Marks took over Brooklyn as general manager, what did he have?
Nothing.
He had no control over his picks, and he had very little talent on his roster. So he's like, okay, the next couple of years are not going to be so good, and we really can't tank, you know, purposely. I mean, they ended up being bad because they just didn't have talent. But he built for 4 years down the line. And it worked. And especially when you're in now, unlike Oklahoma City, Sean had the ability to say, well, we may be able to get people to Brooklyn. And guess what? They did. that, you know, but like, you know, when Hinkie looked at it, you know, I don't know where he assessed Philly's chances of getting free agents, but he certainly wasn't banking on it. And, you know, while I remain puzzled at the way Houston operated for about a, you know, 2 year period, I just was so mystified by some of their decisions. Once from the Harden trade forward, they have really they have got their plan and they are sticking to it, and it's going well for them, and they're following the tactics that you lay out in this book. They were like, listen, man, we have got to get into the bottom of this the bottom record, because we got to get into the top of this draft. So they went, as you mentioned, they went full bore to get in there, and they got better luck, and they get the number two pick instead of number five. Oklahoma City wins the last day of the season. What the Clippers do on their own tank job. And, and now they have a whole bunch of young guys, and they, you know, they're probably going to be awful again this year, but they're going to have a bunch of young guys being awful, which is the same idea that Oklahoma City has.
Yeah.
Like Houston basically went to the script. And, you know, now if I'm a Rocket fan, I'm kind of excited to watch this season, even though they're probably going to lose 60 games.
Yeah. I mean, I'm from Philly originally. That's kind of how this idea to be a book started, where I was coming up in my career blogging for Liberty Ballers at the same time I was in school in Boston and interning at Slam and using a Slam magazine credential to get into TD Garden. And I talked to any Sixers fan who was on board with the process. Like, those years were fun. There was no expectations. Any type of victory was a blast.
Well, they were fun for you because you look at it analytically. I'm not sure how fun they were for the average Sixers fan, though.
No, I disagree with you. I think a lot of fans look back at those years fondly. They look back at Jakar Sampson and Daniel Orton and Darius Johnson Odom and their favorite 10-day guy they had, and turning Robert Covington from a D-League number one pick to a guy who's a sought-after free agent and someone that Portland's trading for to try to appease Damian Lillard. Like, I think the fans, at least the ones I talked to and the ones that were around and actually showing up to the arena at that time, they loved seeing, you know, Bambi's learn how to walk and run, if you will. So, but to the other effect of Houston, like, I don't think fans also realize how thin the line can be between contending and tanking. Like, at a certain point, you can turn that thing around pretty quickly. It's almost like flipping a coin, where with James Harden, right, they were right there year after year, right in the conversation for a championship. He wants out. They trade him. They have the number two pick. Same thing with Boston back in my book timeline, where they were obviously perennial contenders with the big three. They lose Ray Allen to Miami. Rajon Rondo tears his ACL. They lose in the first round of the 2013 playoffs, and all of a sudden they're getting that, you know, mammoth haul from Brooklyn back that turns into Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, and then they make a couple conference finals. Like, I think that's also part of this equation now, where these front offices realize you can flip this thing around pretty quickly, push your chips on the table, and look like the Atlanta Hawks or the Phoenix Suns. Like, you can be out of the playoff picture and right back into the conference finals and the finals pretty soon if you get the right talent. Because in the NBA, that's why tanking, I think, is so prevalent in this league versus others too. As much as there's the cliche that the quarterback is the most important position in all professional sports, we've seen it with, you know, LeBron to like Luka and Trae Young nowadays, right? Where one singular talent, let alone two, if you get a couple of them, you know, there's only five guys on the court and they play both sides of the ball, they can control that whole operation and the entire gymnasium, from the refs to the fans to whatever. You see Trae taking a bow and all MSG blows up, right? So I think that aspect, the power, the singular agency that those guys have, is why tanking is so important. Because even if you lose James Harden or lose KG and Paul Pierce, you can be right back in it in a few years with the guy that you drafted as a result of them leaving.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not that big of an NFL fan, but as somebody who is in, you know, whose life is the NBA, when the Jets won that game last year and gifted, you know, look, and I don't know if Trevor Lawrence is going to be Joe Montana. What do I know? I mean, but I know that a lot of people thought he was, and the difference between him and the other candidates was a gap. Like, the Jets winning that game, like, for an NBA fan, you know, to guarantee that the Jaguars were going to get the number one pick, like, it's a head slapper. I mean, it's a head slapper. But it is an indication of how different the sport is. Because if there was an equivalent of a Trevor Lawrence in the NBA, you would see maybe a longer than a year battle, because they knew Lawrence was going to be the number one pick for 2 years. You know, if another LeBron James came to today, you know, and if there was somebody who at age 16 or 17 had that type of talent, who knows what we would see for the 2 year window before he would have been drafted. LeBron would have been the number one pick as a high school junior.
Yes.
I mean, who knows what would happen in today. Well, let me ask you about today though. Yeah. In this exact moment right now, there aren't many teams tanking in the NBA. The number is way reduced from there was like 2-3 years ago. Even though it looks like we're at a point where there is some pretty significant talent coming in to the league. And I think Tim Bontemps on our staff, he put out a, he does these stories a couple times a year where he surveys executives. And in his story that came out actually on Thursday, it, you know, it talked about how, you know, the executives kind of, you know, there isn't as much tanking as it was before. So maybe it's cyclical. But why do you think that right now, maybe there's less, by the way, that's another reason for Oklahoma City to do it, because if other people are trying to compete, it, you know, going against the grain makes it more valuable. But what about in the current, like this season coming up? I think Oklahoma City and Houston are probably there, but I don't know if there's anybody else.
Yeah, I would agree with that to a certain extent. I will say, you know, I think the 2019 lottery reform definitely dissuaded a lot of people from the odds. And we look at what happened this year with Cleveland jumping up and Toronto jumping up. You know, the odds are definitely more volatile than before. But I will say also, like, before I go there, I'll say the other thing being that with Phoenix and with Drew Holiday being traded to Milwaukee, the Chris Paul, the Drew Holiday effect with LeBron and AD getting hurt. Like, I think across the league right now, we're seeing a lot of teams think they're just one move away from competing for the championship or competing for the playoffs and whatnot. Yeah. And I think that is the concept that, you know, after, you know, the years of LeBron and the Heat and the Warriors and the Cavs and, you know, Spurs versus Lakers and the Celtics of the latter decade. Like, I think right now we're in a period where we haven't been in a long time, where the championship window is considered to be pretty open. But also, I'll push back in that we didn't think Houston was going to tank heading into last season, and we didn't Atlanta was going to tank heading back into last season. And I think, you know, there are tons of teams right now, like Sacramento and New Orleans and San Antonio, and, you know, go to the Eastern Conference with, you know, Toronto and Charlotte and Indiana, like teams that think they're right there in the play-in tournament conversation, right there in the play-in conversation, where, you know, if they get a couple injuries, like the Bucks in 2013-14, who had the number two pick when they took Jabari Parker, like when they drafted Giannis 15th the year before, they thought they were going to be a playoff team and Giannis was going to play all of his rookie year in the D League. Then they had a lot of injuries, the whole Larry Sanders situation. All of a sudden, Giannis plays like 77 games and they're the worst team in the league. So I do want to push back that there aren't as many teams still doing it, because we don't know who's tanking yet, right? I think
that's a very fair point.
Yeah, I think there will be some late entries, like there always is, because at a certain point you realize we got to pull the plug here and get a draft pick after, you know, how struggle some a year we've had.
Right. And because, I mean, again, just analytically looking at it, the teams are going to sit down in December and go, this ain't happening for us. And the move is to go this direction. And we do see that. And, you know, the intricacies of the draft, I mean, you know, when we think of the draft, we think of the moment where the guy puts on the hat, if it is indeed the correct hat, and he goes up and he shakes, you know, Silver is a hugger, you know, Stern wasn't a hugger. Stern wasn't a hugger of anybody, quite frankly. But if Stern had been a hugger, it would be very hard because he was very short relative to these guys. It's an easier hug for Silver, but, you know, Silver is a hugger. But everything that goes into that moment, obviously from the player's side, who they pour their whole lives into this and their family and their support system. But on the team side, everything that goes into that moment, not only in the scouting, but to position themselves for that pick. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, really it you know, it's because it comes so rapid fire, and because the nature of the league is, okay, well, summer league is coming up immediately. And this year it was like, you know, free agency is in 15 minutes.
Yeah, it was dizzy.
It's hard to focus on that moment, but it is like everything. It's like the most sacred thing is that moment. And that, you know, I guess superstar, you know, what decides, you know, championships these days is how superstars try to force their way through free agency or trades to teams. But when it comes to, you know, franchises and the future of the league, it's in that moment. And like, there's such machinations to get to that moment. And that's really what this book is about. And and the book sort of, it makes you a smarter NBA fan.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
It's called Built to Lose: How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. Jake Fisher. You're going to hear more from Jake Fisher in the coming years, is my prediction. If this is the first time, it shouldn't be, because all of my listeners are very educated, Jake. They all know who you are. But if it is the first time you've heard from Jake, I promise you it will probably not be the last. So thanks for doing this. I hope you are enjoying your summer. I won't say where you are right now. This is part of, I'm sure, a very big project, but let's just say you're not sitting at home this summer.
For sure. I thank you again for having me, and I hope to be able to share more about the big project by sometime in October. And okay. we got more stuff coming along at Bleacher Report. So thanks again, man. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Jake. Thank you earlier to Matt. Thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast. Hope you're enjoying your summer. We will talk to you next week.